Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twit. This Week in Google. Episode 131, recorded January 25th, 2012. Be afraid. Or not. This Week in Google is brought to you by Ford, featuring voice-activated Sync App Link. Now you can control your select smartphone apps with your voice, so you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Check it out in the 2012 Ford Fiesta and at Ford.com/technology. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, and a good day to talk about Google. And we have four great panelists to do so. I'll start to my left with Matthew Ingram. He says, I'm the eminence grise and senior writer at GigaOhm.com. Hey, Matthew, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I think this is your first time on Twig, is it not?
I believe it is, yeah.
Welcome. Good to have you. And I see that he has brought his boxing gloves, so watch out, everybody. Also joining us, Gina Trapani from SmarterWear.org.
And hello.
Former founder of Lifehacker. She's, of course, the creator of ThinkUp app. And I forgot to ask you last week, did you meet the prez when you were at the White House?
I didn't. I didn't meet the president, but I met CTO of the United States, and I met the First Lady's Chief of Staff.
Oh, cool.
No Beau sightings either. I didn't see the dog.
No Beau the dog.
But I did get to step into the West Wing.
Ooh.
Momentarily, which was exciting.
Yeah, you don't normally get to go there.
Yeah, no, you don't. The president was definitely hard at work because the Secret Service guy looked like he was about to tackle me because I didn't have the right badge. So
you don't look right, whoever you are.
Yeah, because I look really intimidating.
Yes.
You know? He looked very intimidating,
no,
though,
I
so
bet.
I stepped carefully.
Tread softly.
Yes.
To my right, Mr. Jeff Jarvis, who is calling from Switzerland, from Davos, where he is hanging with the big mucky mucks at the World Economic Forum.
It's cold here. I got to have a hat on.
That's a good hat. Is that the hat that has the built-in earmuffs?
Yeah. Isn't that cool?
I getting bought one of those. It
when I was with Matthew Ingram in Victoria, BC.
Wow. Small world.
It wasn't that cold.
No, but I'm sure it is. What you said,
no,
six,
but it's a good hat for here.
6 feet of snow in the last...
6 feet of snow. 6 feet in the last two weeks, yeah.
Wow.
And by the way, Gina, I was invited to a meeting with the CTO today in Washington, and I was already committed to come here, and it about killed me when I came here instead.
You know, is it an election year or something?
Yeah. You think?
All these bloggers are at the White House. Every 4 years... bloggers get to go to the White House.
Well, I think after SOPA, we'll get to go a lot more often.
Maybe. Little the power of the blog. Also
and
here, and it looks like he's at Macworld Expo because I see the Jukebox Marriott behind him. Mr. Kevin Marks of Salesforce.com and Tumble Vision TV. Hello, Kevin.
Hi there. I'm on top of the center. I'm in the Yerba Buena Gardens, yes.
And are you there for Macworld or something else?
No, I just picked this place as a nice place to sit and chat because I found that all the offices were booked.
Perfect.
All the meeting rooms were booked in Salesforce. So
perfect. Come out here. It's next to the Metreon.
It is.
You can go see an IMAX film.
So there's also this sort of really weird view down here of like, doesn't look like San Francisco. It's full of churches and things.
Yeah, you're in the Yerba Buena Center, which was really quite a great redevelopment project. And they put the Moscone Center is underneath this garden on top. And it's nice. It's pretty. And the Museum of Modern Art is over there. And, of course, as you can see, the reason why they call it the Jukebox Marriott, it looks like a jukebox.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, welcome all. The big story, I don't think there's any question about it this week, and it's all started with the Washington Post a couple of days ago. Washington Post published an article I thought was a little sensationalistic. I'd love to get your take on it, saying, oh, my God, Google is going to update their privacy policies. And somehow they leapt to the conclusion that because of this, the changes were going to make that all of a sudden they were going to aggregate everything they know about you and you couldn't opt out of it. I just scanned them because they have published them now on the official Google blog, and I've just scanned them. And it doesn't seem like that Washington Post article was justified.
Anybody dissent, disagree? Matthew?
Kashmir Hill did a very good story on that, just saying that they didn't really change their policy. They changed some execution of it, but they've always said that they were going to combine stuff, and it only makes sense that they would. That's the point of Google.
What are you going to do, build a firewall between your stuff?
This is the insanity of the privacy insanity.
And it makes sense. In fact, I think it's an improvement to have a unified privacy policy. That's what's unified now, right? We have one privacy policy.
Right, yeah. Across all the products.
That's
they inherited some from the companies they bought that were different, I think. I think YouTube had a different one.
Ah.
That's the point.
Right, some of the products had different ones. You know, I fell into the headline trap about this yesterday, where I was like, this is terrible. Google's being aggressive and making this horrible change that you can't opt out of. And this is totally against their entire ethos about user control and openness. And, you know, this is terrible. It's so Facebook-like. And then I actually read about it. I think Peter Kafka did a good piece where it was like, you know, Google maintains an archive of all their privacy policies over time. Right. And they've always said that they may, use data from other services, usage, behavioral data from other services that they, I mean, we obviously know they can. It's all one company. And now they're saying they may. And this consolidation just makes that very clear, right? So that may not have been laid out very clearly in separate, in different product privacy policies. But now there's one privacy policy and it makes it really clear. So nothing has really changed. I mean, I was thinking, you know, a few days ago before this story broke, if someone had asked me, does Google take the things that you do on YouTube and use it to inform the ads it shows you in Google search, I would have said,
well, of course.
Well, certainly they can, and I don't see why they wouldn't. It's all one company. I mean, you know,
right.
It's all one company's product. So, you know, what's the big deal? But then they announced this change, which is them being upfront and saying, hey, this change is going to happen in a month or two. It's going to be the same for everywhere. And we're just being really clear and consolidating 60 documents.
They're being transparent, right, Jim?
Yeah, they're being transparent. Well, and they're saying, hey, you know, you can just close your account if you don't like it, which, you know, they didn't quite say that. But that was what the non-opt-out piece of that sensationalist headline came from. In the end, I was like, this really isn't that big a deal. Just the timing was bad after Search Plus Your World.
See, that's what I think. I think what's interesting is how people's perceptions have changed. And I think it's partly because of Google Search Plus Your World. I think some people, at least, are a lot more sensitive about, is Google doing this stuff for me or is it doing it for its own purposes? So before they might have thought, oh, Google just shows me the results that are really relevant to me. Except now they're thinking, oh, no, Google's showing me Google Plus results because that's what they want. So now they're distorting things in a way to their own benefit. So whereas
that's
before,
a good point, Matthew.
someone might have said, oh, I think Google is pretty fair with my privacy. I think now they're a little bit more suspicious if they're going to share all that information.
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I visited the Munich offices of Google this week, and those are the guys. It's almost all privacy because they're on the front line of privacy.
They're in
Germany.
In Blermany, yeah.
Exactly. And interestingly, you know, because I was talking to them in part about the need to not just talk about transparency and talk about benefits, but also to create more products that have benefits. And they said, interestingly, after all the furor over the Verpixelungsrecht of Street View and Wave and all that, Google Priority Inbox, Germans love it. Nary a complaint. And, you know, and Google's reading your email. Look what they're doing. But the value is so high, nobody bitches.
Well, and I've talked to some Germans, including Chris Marquardt, who's a regular contributor here, lives in Tübingen. He said, you know, I don't think the German public share this fear that the German government has. The German public loves Google and loves to use it.
Exactly.
Now, let me, this is the article that raised people's ire, including yours, Gina, on the Washington Post yesterday. Google announces privacy changes across products. Users can't opt out. That's the headline.
Ooh.
Cecilia Kang writing, she says, the web giant announced Tuesday it plans to follow the activities of users across nearly all of its ubiquitous sites, including YouTube, Gmail, and its leading search engine. Google has already been collecting some of this information, but for the first time, it is combining data across its websites to stitch together a fuller portrait of users. It says consumers who are logged into Google services won't be able to opt out of the changes, which take effect March 1st. Is any of that wrong? That's not factually an error.
I don't think it's the first time they've shared information.
Well, and I don't want to be an apologist for Google by any means, but we've shared this Google dashboard many times, google.com/dashboard, mm-hmm. when you log into your account. Google has been more transparent than almost, look, this is my general response to people when they come to me. In fact, somebody, a friend of mine, doctor, said today, he came to me and said, what should I do? And I said, you know, who knows more about you than Google? Oh, your internet service provider. What's their privacy policy?
Right.
Do they have one? They know more than what you do. This is only stuff that you visit on Google. And Google is very, I think, upfront about exposing what they know in this dashboard. Is there any contention that this dashboard is not full, complete, and accurate? I think
that's
it's
what
everything.
I've heard.
Right. Kevin, what's your thought on it? You actually worked for the evil, I mean Google.
No, I think you know, the product teams were fairly independent, and there wasn't as much coordination as there could have been. And one of the things that's changed since Larry Page took over is that they are trying to focus this stuff more. And you know, the way the black bar stuff, the logins, and the Google Plus everywhere is part of that. And I think this privacy policy is another aspect of that. If they're going to start actually coupling all the products together much more consistently, then converging, that makes sense too. I think, you know, historically there were a bunch of different product teams that had come from acquisitions and things and had some variations in privacy policy and in profiles as well. Google still has several different profiles. There's profiles on Blogger, profiles on YouTube, and the sort of core profiles that are on the other services, and they're trying to converge those as well. So I suspect this is sort of reflecting that general management effort to make Google more coherent and more one Google.
You're exactly right, Matthew. I mean, Kevin. Yeah, when I went for a book talk at Google HQ, they were in the middle of Privacy Week, and they have these principles of privacy. When I went to the Munich headquarters, they're up all on the walls. They're really working very hard. And, you know, we can criticize Google for other things, but I think compared to Facebook, compared to Twitter, compared to your ISP, Google's been doing better work. But it's just this reflexive Google hatred that takes over the world.
I think it is the perception.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Matthew.
I think the perception is changing, and I think things like Google Search Plus Your World are doing that. I think people are questioning, so they're losing a little bit of trust maybe that Google is doing this for their benefit or being as open and transparent as possible. I think that's a real problem for them.
It is, Matthew, but then again, you know, Facebook is using everything you tell them.
Facebook doesn't have to say, oh, we're going to combine information from your profile and your fan page. Of course they are.
But Google was always different.
I think
people always assumed Google was better, you know, more objective, more in it for you, less kind of in it for them.
But they are in it. That's the point, Matthew. They are in it for us. Why are they doing this stuff? Not just for advertising, but they're going to focus and give us a better service. I mean, I'm sounding like a Google fanboy, even though I am one, but they're going to use this information to give us more relevant results.
Well, okay, sure. M.G. Siegler said an interesting thing. He said, and this is relevant to the conversation we had last week, which was about Search Plus Your World. And we talked a lot about it last week on Twitter and on this show in negative terms. He said, look, it's Google's a private enterprise. They have the right to, you know, do what they can to maximize profits. My only issue, and I think this is, I would agree with him, is it makes the search results less good. And we showed that when you search for Mark Zuckerberg, instead of some sites that might legitimately tell you about Mark Zuckerberg, what you get is Mark Zuckerberg's Google Plus account where he has never posted anything. So clearly that's not as good a search result. And Google's doing that in order to promote their own product. So they're trading promotion for quality. And that's what MG said, and I agree with him.
And there was a sense of betrayal there, for sure.
Yeah,
It's
their right to do it. I think that they're to be commended for being clear about what they're collecting and give you a privacy policy. What's unfortunate is there isn't any really credible competition for Google. Certainly no competition that's not doing the same thing. Bing's doing the same thing.
Right.
And I think if you look at, I don't want to get too much into the Google Search Plus Your World again, but if you look at what they've said about why or how they don't favor Google Plus, some of that is, if not outright lying, then clearly just, you know, twisting the truth.
Well, we should have had you here last week, Matthew Ingham, because we had Matt Cutts on. Now, he admittedly, this isn't his division, and he wasn't speaking for Google in this case. But he did make the argument, which I found somewhat credible, we don't want to base social results on something we can't control. And we learned that from Twitter, our experience with Twitter, we can't control that data. Right. We can't control the Facebook data. So we have to use our own social graph. At least we control that. Is that not you believe that's disingenuous?
I think that's disingenuous.
No,
because they can't. they can't control the web, and they base their index on the web. So that's there's noise there, right?
It's ridiculous.
The focus on the user.org thing, the thing that Facebook and Twitter and co. put up to point this out is really interesting. I don't know if you've played with that.
It is.
Because what they did, you can read the JavaScript, what they do is they do the Google Plus, your world search, and then they, if you click their bookmarklet, they go and do a plain Google search from the API, and they replace the Google Plus results with things that rank higher for that person that come from social networking sites, and the results get better. It fixes the Zuckerberg problem, it fixes a bunch of these other things, it stops pointing to Google Plus affirmatively. That is making it clear that Google's got the thumb on the scales for Google Plus, but we knew that. And I think Matt was being a bit disingenuous about that. But the other half of this is that Twitter and Facebook do make it hard to crawl them now. If you actually try and pull Facebook down with curl, it says your browser is not supported. They explicitly send you a not supported page unless you lie about what browser you are.
Would Google's new search features provide?
You could cut the audio on this, John. I'm just showing the video from this is right. Focus on the user.org if you want to know more. And they give an example as you were saying, and you could do your own searches of if you search for Hugh Jackman on Google Plus versus Hugh Jackman, which is in an actual search result. The results are somewhat different. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. San Francisco Fire Department, on the other hand, may indeed choose to interrupt.
Make sure they go past. Okay. So the thing is that Twitter puts no follow on all outbound links, and it also routes them all through t.co now. So that's basically saying to Google's indexer, do not follow this link.
You're saying Twitter... Not Google. Twitter
puts no follow.
Twitter
on
does
no follow and does and uses their own shortening service
and cut off the fire hose. All three, yes.
Right?
Yeah. So the cut off the fire hose is a there's a he said she said thing about that, but it's
negotiation.
Basically, Twitter jacked up the price and Google balked at the price, but who knows what was doing? Who was deciding what there, but. It is a massive shame. Losing that real-time search is a big hole in Google's results. And Matt's right about that. That was a beautiful feature they had to take away because Twitter pulled the plug on the contract or Google refused to pay it or whichever way around it is. But they were able to crawl... They are able to crawl Twitter. The Twitter guy said, you've crawled 150 million pages off Twitter last week. What are you complaining about?
Right.
And the answer is they're complaining that they cannot get links out from Twitter because Twitter is no following them all, which is... I had a bit of a back and forth with Sam Palera at Twitter on this, because the nofollow thing was originally designed for third-party content. So the idea of if you've got a blog post that has comments on it, the nofollow was designed to go on links that are in your comments that weren't posted by you, but not on links in the post that were posted by you, so that you're not accidentally getting page rank to spammers through that.
And this was an extension that Google created and promoted.
Right.
Yes.
To keep people from artificially boosting Google juice by posting on other people's blogs. And now Twitter is using this in a way that wasn't intended.
But Twitter's doing it because Google wants them to.
Yeah, Twitter is awkward because it doesn't have that second-party, third-party distinction because there isn't a distinction between a comment and a post. So a tweet... from me is from me, but a response from you to it is still a tweet from you. And there's two things going on here. One is that Google assigns PageRank for the whole domain, they can't distinguish between twitter.com/KevinMarks, twitter.com/JeffJarvis easily. That's what they say. That's what Matt says about this.
But here's the question. Let's say Twitter reversed their policy and Facebook reversed their policy. Would Google really even want this? Isn't
they say they do? Yes.
Don't they really
prefer
it's
more stuff?
Well, but don't they really prefer
because they're the search?
Go ahead, Ben. It's been to Google, right?
I mean, these engineers. Fixed these search results with one JavaScript file. This focus on the user weekend project is one is a bookmarklet. It's a JavaScript
so funny.
File.
Yeah.
How hard could it be?
A lot. I mean, it really was a very, very good. It was a really, really good project that made a really good point, which was if a bookmarklet can figure out that this famous chef updates his Twitter profile a lot more than he does his Google Plus profile, and that if you search for him, the Twitter his Twitter profile should show up first, then Google certainly can.
It's even better than that. They're actually using Google signals to do that. They're using Google's raw search ranking to decide which one to replace it with.
So I'll give you an example here.
They're reflecting Google's opinion.
This is a search, John, if you pull up my page, on music as revealed by Search Plus Your World. You see on the right people and pages on Google Plus, Britney Spears. I don't even know who David Guetta is, and Lil Wayne. Lady Gaga noticed she wasn't on this list, so she suddenly joined Google Plus. Now I click the Don't Be Evil link, and these are massaged by Focus on the User. And now we actually get something completely different. We get some songs. I'm not sure how this is improved. This is MySpace?
Two of them, Britney and
Britney's MySpace and David Guetta. So what they did is they replaced Google Plus with MySpace. That's interesting.
Well, for music, but not for
according
others,
to
it's Twitter first, you know.
Right.
Because
all it shows is what
saying,
has the most page rank.
Well, let me look up Obama. That would be presumably not going to give me MySpace, right? I don't get any Google Plus results here, so maybe they aren't evil when you search on the president. I don't know.
If you search for cooking.
Cooking? All right, let's try that. Cooking. And now I'm getting Jamie Oliver, Alton Brown, and Lee Allison. Oh, by the way, I'm getting ads. Okay. Lee Allison from Google Plus. Let's de-evilize it. I love that bookmark. And now we're getting Facebook,
Twitter.
Google Plus, MySpace. We're getting Twitter, tweets. Yeah.
LinkedIn.
Much better. And that's funny because Google has that information. That's the point.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
all right.
So that just answered the question. If Google had the information, would they want to use it? No. They want to promote Google Plus.
Well, that was the argument Matt made, was that if they can't reliably have it, I'm not justifying it, but he was saying that they're not going to include it as a feature unless they know that feature is secure.
Mm.
I'm not judging because
One of the other things they did last week was deprecate the Social Graph API. That was sort of buried in their list of things they were getting rid of. And that really worries me because the Social Graph API was the thing that Brad Fitzpatrick wrote that crawls the RelMe and RelFriend links on the web to construct a social graph from the public web. It's kind of useful. You put your URL in there, and it tells you what other URLs are yours that are connected by RelMe links, and you can see who you've linked to by friend links. But what happened, and that was what was used for the previous social search. If you actually go to the old S2 social search thing, it will still show you that graph, but they basically said we're taking this API away.
I know, because I added all those links.
Yes.
All the RelMe links to my sites some time ago.
And that's the point. This is how you do distributed social. That was the point of that spec from, that's XFN, which is a 2003 spec.
So why did they deprecate it? Did they say?
Usage. Now, part of the reason they deprecated it is that when Twitter went to new Twitter, the RelMe links is still there, but the RelFriend links all went away. And Twitter's connection graph is no longer crawlable. If you actually look at their robots.txt, the following pages are behind a login wall, and they don't want you crawling that. So basically, you cannot crawl the link graph of Twitter anymore, which means that this is no longer deriving link graphs from Twitter. And I think possibly having problems with Facebook as well. Facebook does show that, but Facebook never showed you all the friends. They would only show you like five of them on the page that was crawlable. And so it had to statistically accumulate them over time or something. So the link graphs are no longer part of the public web from either of those companies.
Their excuse is the API isn't experiencing the kind of adoption we'd like. Which is true. I doubt very many people did what I did.
It's still costing anything to keep it running. That's the thing. Right. It is. The thing is, it's a very useful. I wrote those sample apps there, so I'm probably biased here. But it is useful because it's actually quite hard and expensive to crawl the web. And so to follow all those links with your own crawler, to say, okay, I've got Leo Laporte's page, what are the rest of his pages? That would involve me visiting all those web pages and following all the me links and deriving it. Google already does that. They crawl the entire web all the time. So caching that for other people is a really useful service. It's basically taking Google's crawl and giving something back. So dropping that, I think, is a shame. I can sort of see why, because the other companies haven't necessarily kept this up, but it's still a step away from the open web, if you like. The other link thing, the nofollow piece, is Twitter is not passing through PageRank to anything that's posted on Twitter. When Google had the firehose, they were using those links, but they're now strictly obeying the nofollows that Twitter puts on, which means there's no PageRank flowing from Twitter to Foursquare or Instagram or anything like that. And I had this conversation with Dennis Crowley of Foursquare yesterday, that they get a lot of traction from links being posted on Twitter, but they're not showing up on the search because of it, because those links, that link is not counted by Google.
But Kevin, wasn't the nofollow, isn't that something that Google requires so that you don't flow page rank to things? Doesn't it penalize you if you flow page rank to things that
there's spam a mess and so on? There, and it needs updating. It would be good to get Matt Cutts in a room with the people at Twitter who were responding in that sense. But yeah, the issue is that what Google really needs to make sense of Twitter in its terms is to understand the links between the different Twitter profiles and the links that are tweets and retweets, so that it can build a trust, a PageRank trust for the Twitter set of pages. And without those follow links, it cannot get the who's more interesting because they got more followers type information out of it. Because they're not allowed to flow PageRank from the tweets to the links in the tweets, they can't use the sort of trending links there as a signal anymore. Which means that posting a link on Twitter is not helping people find it on Google, and that's a problem.
And I think that I wrote something recently.
We're losing signal here.
And I think both Google and Twitter and all their users are the ones who suffer. I mean, I wrote a whole blog post about the relationship between these two companies, feeling like a couple that has broken up or a couple that's divorcing. You've got Google saying it's your fault, and Twitter saying no, it's your fault, and Google's saying, well, you left first, and Twitter's like, well, you didn't, buy
you
me.
You were seeing other social networks.
But what? I don't think we're being tough enough.
But to me,
the bad part is users.
Go ahead, Matt.
Users are the ones who suffer. Twitter has virtually no useful search. Let's face it; their search doesn't show up things. It only lasts for like 5 days, I think now. It's basically useless. So then you have to go to Topsy, which is okay, but it's not great. If Google had that fire hose, it would be fantastic. It would be great for Google users. It would be great for Twitter users. But
I think we've got to ask
here we are watching mom and dad fight over the kids.
Go ahead, Jeff.
We've got to ask a question about Twitter here. And I'm not trying to attack Twitter, but I'm just saying that Google always gets under the laser light, and then Facebook gets under the laser light. Twitter generally doesn't. And I still go back, and Gina, you've defended Twitter, but I still think that Twitter's behavior toward its developers is pretty schmucky.
Yes.
And that Twitter doing things like being passive aggressive and insisting on its own clients to not do retweet the way the whole world wants retweet done and stuff. And then there's a back and forth between mom and dad. You're right, Matthew, in terms of the fire hose. But Twitter should want to say you should be able to find tweets, our tweets. They're our tweets anywhere. They're not Twitter's tweets, damn it. And
that's
so I just think we need to put a little more attention on Twitter and ask whether they're being good or evil. And I'm not answering the question, but I want to ask it more
Jeff,
often.
Jeff, we posed this question 2 or 3 years ago. Remember Bear Hug Camp with Steve Gilmore? We went there. We covered it live. I've been saying this all along.
We
should do another Bear Hug Camp. I mean, at that time, Steve was upset about the loss of track. But really, the issue is that Twitter silos this information.
Yeah.
Now, a very interesting article on TechCrunch from Devin Coldway, who says that Google going evil has become the Godwin's Law of tech commentary.
I love that. It's so true.
He says that basically what's happened is there's bias. People want so badly for Google to do something truly evil that they're actually expecting it. And so that's why you get things like, oh, my God, they did it.
It's really bad in Europe, but you're right. The Washington Post did it this week.
Yeah,
God,
I expect
I
more
that.
From
Godwin's
them.
Wall.
Yeah, Godwin's law.
It's so true. I was saying on Twitter yesterday that that Google's values, I prefer, this is a very general statement, but I prefer Google's values over their products and Apple's products over their values. So whenever I feel like Google's values are compromised, mm-hmm. I freak out because I feel like, you know, Google is sort of the conscience of the industry, whereas, right. whereas Apple is kind of the forefront of design. So, you know, I would be just as quick to point out if Apple made a crappy product. I'm still waiting for that to happen. Well, I mean, that's happened
that's
in the past.
That's a good point. We expect Apple to be evil, right? We expect Apple to do things that are only in its interests. But we've always expected Google, we've sort of held it to a higher standard.
So
when it drops below that, I think people...
Yeah. I'm gonna see Schmidt and company here at Davos on Friday. Is there any question that you want to deputize me to ask?
Well, this is a good one to start with. This is Sarah Lacey writing in the new Pando Daily, which has issues, which we should talk about at some point. But she does point out... she does... I mean, I guess what you should say is consider the source. But she does point out that Chris Sacca, who's probably an investor in Pando Daily, has says that three Googlers...
Isn't everybody an investor in
Pando
Daily?
Everybody is. If you're on Page... What is it? Page Mill Road. You're an investor. Apparently, Larry Page to Googlers is the headline. If you don't get Search Plus Your World, work somewhere else. Apparently... at a Friday staff event after the launch, he said, and this is a quote, but again, kind of unsourced, this is the path we're heading down, a single, unified, beautiful product across everything. If you don't get that, you should probably work somewhere else.
Well, this is Apple's value seeping into Google, right? Like, this is how I read that. That worried me. I was like, oh, these are Apple's value seeping into Google. And that's something that I've actually, I think Google has a lot to learn from Apple, as I think Apple has a lot to learn from Google.
But aren't they saying this to not just their employees, but users as well? And this is the thing that bugs me a little bit. Hey, you can opt out. Stop using Google.
No, but you see, Leo, you're hitting the law there. You're a little bit far. What they're saying to employees is that we've been saying that Google doesn't have a strong enough strategy. That it was all over the map. So now they're on the map, and you're saying, "Oh, well, we don't like this map. It's their map." Nikesh Arora was at the VLD conference in Munich a couple days ago, and I heard him talk. And obviously, he's giving the company line. And the company line is that we're moving as a whole here, not just Google, but as a whole from the information age back to people. And that's where Google is, and that's where the strategic view is. And can like or dislike it, but it's a corporate strategy that they're saying.
And you know what? That is a good goal. I mean, what he's describing, mm-hmm. Search Plus Your World, is actually a great idea. I think having social search results in your search results, but they're not doing what they claim to be doing.
No, they're not executing well.
A broad enough search, and they're not ranking it the way they do other things. And that's what the plugin shows you.
You can't reduce the number of choices, right? Like, you can't offer something, like, if you were selling a product, you can't offer a product for free and then make it cost money. Like, the psychological impact of that is people get upset. You know, Google's, you know, has always been about choice and control and openness. And I think that, you know, the no opt-out part of the privacy policy headline, the sensationalist headline, is a thing that got me. Because I thought, hey, mm-hmm. you know, Google's all about choice and control, and now they're not, right? Apple's never about choice and control. Apple starts out with CRM, and then they remove
it. It's about how you don't
Google's
have
going
it.
The other
yeah.
way. Right. You know, lots of choices, and now they're reducing choices. So the feeling, I agree that it's the right path, but it's why people are freaking out. Because you can't, you know, you don't want to raise prices. So it's just they're going to suffer through these kinds of PR problems regularly if it keeps going this way, this reduction.
Yeah, and I think saying you can stop using all Google's products, that's great. So I can't use any Google service if I don't want to have my information shared.
Well,
that's
can you opt
they're
out?
Not saying
can I opt out if I log out? Do I not opt out?
Yeah, you can log out. Right, you log out. Yeah. Right. None of this kicks in. And also, just something important to note, double-click cookie tracking and Google Analytics tracking is not covered underneath this new privacy policy change. Like, that's totally separate things.
So it doesn't sound too... Truthfully, what really happened here... is that Google kind of made some technical changes that this is completely separate from Search Plus Your World. I realize we've got two conversations going on here. But it made some technical changes that allowed them to unify all this data. And as a result, they've given us a unified privacy policy. And under normal circumstances, people would say, that's great. Now we want a simple, normal. This is what you ask of Facebook, isn't it? Give us a policy that's universal and clear so we understand it. Google's policy isn't changing, by the way. I've lost the article now, but somebody did a search back to 2005. It's been doing the same basic policy all along. It's just now
a unit.
Yeah. So
But I think it shows, that shows, the response, I think, shows that Google has lost some trust.
I think you're right and wrong. In terms of the recent Search Plus stuff, in our circles, I don't think that's really in the world yet. In our circles, yeah, we're getting a little suspicious. But in general, there's just this general Godwin's law when it comes to Google, that they're big and big is bad and almost anti-capitalist at some point over here in Europe. And I see it all the time. And I don't think that's because of anything they've done. I think that's just because they're big and successful. And it was Microsoft before them.
Although, you know, I have to say my daughter, my 18-year-old daughter, said to me, what's going on with Google? Why are they pulling all my information and not letting me opt out?
You know, that's like my doctor saying it.
That's like my doctor saying it. He's not a techie. Mm-hmm. But he says, I'm a doctor. I have to be very careful about what's online with me. Now, should I worry? Should I stop using Google? This is the universal response to this. But you're right. It's the press. It's Washington Post specifically.
And it's government, too. I'm seeing that in Europe. We'll get to it in a few minutes. But over here in Europe, there's just awful SOPA squared stuff happening with this. And it's going to affect not just Google, but the whole entire Internet is getting cooties.
It'll be interesting to see how Google's new pool all your information and do whatever we want with it is going to fly with European regulators.
And let's be honest, as you point out, Matthew, in your article on GigaOM, this Don't Be Evil plugin was written by one of the developers who works for Facebook. So it's also Facebook, right? It's also competitors. It's Twitter and Facebook saying Google's being evil. And I think that's really what we're seeing, by the way. I mean, let's really be honest, is intense competition among Facebook, Google, Twitter. you can include some other companies in on that. And Microsoft. And as the competition ramps up, companies start acting more in their own interest. They're fighting it out, and that's what
and it's going to cross against cable industry and telephone industry.
It's going to get stronger, of course. Yeah,
and let's face it, that's why Google Plus was created in the first place.
Right,
it's not because Google suddenly felt that it had to let you share photos of your cat with everyone. It was because they wanted to get those social signals that they could use to improve search, improve targeting, and so on. And that's the holy grail.
This is something that happened, and I don't know what happened, but something happened, maybe because the stakes are so high all of a sudden, but a couple of years ago, we all observed this. There was suddenly this kind of animosity. Apple hates Google. I mean, really hates Google. Facebook really hates Twitter. I mean, there was this battle all of a sudden among these companies where in the past there might have been some sort of sense of kind of we're all in it together.
Is there any hope that SOPA brings us back together for a group hug?
but I just want to say one thing. Isn't that what we all say we want? We want competition. Yeah. Isn't that what we're all talking? We don't want monopoly. We want competition. So a stronger Google and a stronger Facebook is good for the users, isn't it?
Good point.
But that's why Google putting its thumb on the scale is so important.
But
because
they're
tipping the balance.
Facebook,
they're tipping the balance, and they're using their search market position to do that.
But they're both doing
Facebook
it. Doesn't make
puts
it
its whole fist on the scale.
Twitter puts
its whole fist on the scale.
Admittedly, it doesn't.
They don't control 60% of the search market.
Kevin Marks, go ahead.
So, Jeff, they do, but Google doing it too doesn't make it better. It makes it worse. Maybe Google is in somewhat poking at Facebook and Twitter, saying, make yourself more crawlable, please, so that we can crawl you better. That's clearly part of what Matt was saying last week. That they don't have specialized access; they have to crawl them, but they're crawling them in the constraints of what they publish. So there is definitely that, and as you said previously, Facebook has briefed against them and said, oh look, Google is pulling your private Facebook data out when it was actually the stuff that was public. So there's animosity there, but the kind of competition you want is not sort of, attacking competition. You want competition where they're competing to serve us better, not where they're competing to get each other out of the picture.
Exactly.
The difference between the old browser wars, where it was use our browser because we've got these special features the other guys don't have, and the new browser wars, which is use our browser because we're implementing the open standards of the web better than the other guys, and it's more responsive. And we want to move to that kind of competition as opposed to the competition of we're doing this thing just to spite each other. So there's a way of competing in a sort of positive some way as opposed to a negative some way. And that's the piece that's probably the thing that makes me most sad about this is that we're losing we're losing a lot of the open webness of this stuff. There is this
competition for quality.
You're only social inside silos. Yeah. Now, we had this sort of very distributed graph of information that was the blogosphere, that was the equivalent of what we use Twitter for now. And I was able to write a search engine at Technorati that could crawl that because it was all in public and it was on multiple people's servers. And it, you know, no one company controlled all of it. There were a few companies that were fairly big that you had to deal with specially, but we could do that. Now, that stuff is not crawlable in the same way. And the other thing is, we had a convention for pinging to say something is new, something has changed, come and crawl this now, which meant that Technorati didn't have to crawl the entire web. We were told by the blog software when something had changed. That piece is a big chunk of what Google got from the firehose was a notation that these things have changed now. If they do it with standard crawl, they've got to basically keep hitting pages and guessing when they've changed. They don't get that feed of updates. And we don't have... Well, that's not quite true. We do have a standard for how to do this with PubSub Hubbub, but that is designed for a distributed world, not for these centralized worlds where you really do need a feed from one company to the other to make it useful. And the other part of this is that Google Plus itself doesn't have a good API for this, or rather the Google Plus API has a 5,000 calls a day limit, which means you can't get Firehose access to Google Plus.
True.
And Google's response is, well, crawl us like we crawl the web. It's like, well, yeah, but we don't actually have the infrastructure to do that. It would be nice if you set an example by making your API available, too.
That's a great point.
Let me wrap up this conversation by asking each of you, has Google changed? What has changed? Is this a suddenly evil Google, Kevin Marks?
I don't think it's a suddenly evil Google. I think it's a suddenly more insular Google. Or more obviously insular Google. They're starting to say, oh, right, we'll do this ourselves because you won't cooperate with us. And I sense that frustration. I was there when we were having versions of these battles with Facebook where Facebook would say, no, you can't call our API, stop it. And then it was like, okay, you say we're violating your terms of service, what could we change to not violate them? We're not telling you. So those kinds of sort of bad blood conversations have happened. The way forward for me is to make this part of the open web, to make this stuff out there in public that people can make sense of, and that's the bit that's being lost in these battles. People are sort of cutting off access to each other's stuff, and that's the piece that Google is being more aggressive in those terms, and that's the piece that's
has Google changed, Jeff Jarvis?
I think Google has not learned grace. I think that the problem is
nerds are not graceful. Let's face it.
No, and they're creating a new feature, which I think we would intellectually agree is the right direction for them and the right direction for where the internet is headed. And
we've been saying this all year that they have to have social. Yeah,
but they're doing two things wrong. One, they're doing it clumsily, and I think that again, I'll defend the beta view. I can defend that part. But what I think that they've got to learn is, and I'm of two minds with this, but they've got to learn how to be more graceful in terms of how they speak with the public, and they haven't learned that. Now, part of that, the bad part of that, is if they become pure PR speak. I don't want them to become fake about it, but I want them to be more human and realize. Nikesh Arora was at DLD, and he was very, very good, but he came up with a line. I thought, there's an Eric line where he said, well, you're not going to have a good experience on the web if you're anonymous. He said it worse. He said, you can't be... you're going to have to being anonymous on the web won't work. And I thought, oh boy, where does it go? But I knew what he was saying. He was saying you're not going to have a less good experience. But they've got to think this through first and realize how they're seen and become graceful out of that, and they're not. So I think that the changes they're making are not evil. They're clumsy, but clumsy in potentially a very damaging way.
Gina?
Google has changed. It has not become more evil. It has become more focused. The problem is it has to work twice as hard to prove that focus does not equal evil. And like what Jeff just said, the clumsiness is an issue. So they need to take things like focus on the user and iterate based on them. They need to be open about that kind of feedback and show. They need to respond to things like the NIM wars more quickly, which they did finally respond to that. Pseudonyms are allowed, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But they need to be more responsive and more iterative more quickly, and they need to be more elegant and better about communicating, just like what Jeff said, being less clumsy. So they're more focused, but they need to work harder to communicate that that doesn't mean necessarily more evil.
Is there someone at Google besides Matt Cutts? Should Larry, this should be Larry? Who should do this? Who's capable of doing this?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Who's the...
Well, Larry's better learn. Larry better friggin' learn.
Larry's, I think it's got to be Larry.
It's his vision. It has to be.
I agree.
And this focus is his obsession. I mean, this is, you know, you know, some people might say this is about him, you know, his meeting with Jobs, right? I mean, this is what Steve Jobs' advice to him was to become more focused.
And the problem is that
Steve Jobs never talked to the public.
No, he wasn't very good at that. Although, he did those emails, and in some ways those emails were a very clever PR strategy.
But he was never great. God knows he was not graceful.
No. Right. Well, he was straightforward and honest, and I think he understood better than anyone the value of good public relations. It didn't seem that way, I know, sometimes, but I think he actually knew it. He was pretty clever about
media. He cared more about public relations than about media relations. That's one way of putting it.
Well, I disagree, because he knew who to suck up to in the media, too. Let me tell you, he knew very well who was powerful. And when Walt Mossberg, you know, comes to his house and spends 3 hours with him, that's not because he likes Walt so very, very much.
Larry doesn't have that.
Larry's missing that. But it shows you don't have to be a nice, wonderful, friendly, charismatic. Well, no. I guess Steve was charismatic, but you don't have to be a lovable person to do that. Yeah. But you have to have some focus and vision. And unfortunately, I'm just pulling up this story on Fox News. This just crossed the wire. Be afraid. Google's spying on you. New policy rolls out March 1st.
Oh, God.
Effing News Corp.
And guess where it comes from? The Wall Street Journal.
The Journal. Oh, don't get me started. Well, you will get me started momentarily.
So can we compare the Wall Street Journal's privacy policy? Because they insist you log in and track you with cookies.
Not only that, they know your PII. They know your name and address and credit card number. They do not allow you to opt out. They require you to be cookied. They sell your data to third parties. They finally had to admit all that stuff after doing their spooky series. Don't get me started.
By the way, it's Julia Angwin again. Although, I got to say, the Wall Street Journal headline, as opposed to the Fox News headline, is much less sensational. It's merely Google widens its tracks, privacy changes to combine data on users, making anonymity harder to keep. Much more judicious and accurate than the Fox News article, which links right back to the Wall Street Journal article. Be afraid. So I agree with you, Gina. This is a communications issue, very much so. Yes. Matthew, we lost you for a little bit. I don't know if you heard how much of this conversation you heard, but the question is, has Google changed? Is this a different Google, and what do they need to do?
I think it has changed. I'm not going to say they've become evil and so on. I'm sure they wish that phrase had never entered the lexicon. But yeah. So whether they've gotten evil or not, I don't want to say. But I do think if you look at what Google promised when it went public, it was going to provide objective results. It was not going to influence those results based on who paid it money or whatever. But now it sure looks like Google is influencing those results based on what it wants to do, which is to promote its own network. And I think that fundamentally changes the nature of what Google is selling or pitching. And so that's, you know, to me, that's a risk. And I think, as Kevin was saying, the biggest risk is that it's just going to change the sort of openness and the we came to rely on Google for that. So now if it's just going to do what everybody else does and sort of pimp its own stuff, that's going to change things fundamentally. That's a problem.
Although you got to feel for Google a little bit, because that is a subtle, and I think you're exactly right, distinction between the old and the new. But Fox is not going to make that distinction.
And Google did not handle it well.
And Google has to consider real people, not us. They have to consider, you know, we can understand the nuance. We could say, they're hurting their search results. That's not what the guy on the street is thinking about. They're thinking about, is Google following me everywhere I go, and what are they doing with what they know?
Right, especially given the stuff that's going on with the FTC, and again, I keep on presaging this, but here in Europe, they've got to be hypersensitive, and this was not hypersensitive.
I'm tempted just to say, hey, Google, I'll do it for you. Give me, I'll take a month leave. Let me just go. I can explain it to people. Really, it's
Yeah.
Because it's just they are not communicating, I think, well at all.
The story really should have been they clarified their language versus made a change.
Right.
This is less about a change and more about clarifying their language.
It's a good news. A unified privacy policy. This is good. Yeah. This is clarity. This is what we always want Facebook to do. This is not, we're trying to hide something. Or, we're not going to let you opt out anymore. There isn't a change in the way they deal with your data.
Right.
Right. They're just letting you know now, clearly.
Yeah.
There could be a change. We don't know.
Well, I'm looking. We kind of know because they've now published it.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't look like it's a change.
But how are they going to share it? Are they going to share more? They're going to share more between things?
It's exactly the same.
It's the same.
They're just unifying it. They're doing exactly what they've said they've done. They haven't changed anything. Let's go to a break.
But that's the problem is that does not generate page views to say that. What generates page views is be afraid.
I'm going to make you afraid in a minute. We come back from break. Yeah. I want to make you very afraid.
Film at 11. Are people rampaging in the streets about to kill you? Film at 11. Stay tuned. But first, by the way, the answer, no. But first, a word from Ford. You know, that's what I love about engineers. And so what I love about doing a technology network, and it's so different from mainstream media, is we assume the intelligence of our audience. And like engineers, things tend to be black and white. We're looking for truth. And maybe things are nuanced in all sorts of interesting ways. But ultimately, I think engineers always say, well, it works or it doesn't work. It is or it isn't. And that's why I love working in this field, because it isn't so. It's not like nailing Jell-O to a tree, despite what they say. We're going to talk a little bit about Ford right now. And I have to say, I love talking about Ford, because this is an example of a company that, I love. When we went to Detroit we went out on the assembly line of their original plant, the one that Henry Ford built in the 20s, because he knew Henry Ford's goal was, at the time when he started Ford, only very rich people could drive. And his goal was to make a car that he said, I want to put everyone in the United States on the road. I want to make a car anyone can drive. I want to make it accessible to all. And to that end, he built this plant that took, boxcars of lumber and iron ore and coke in one end, and cars came out the other end. This amazing, massive plant, and it's still there. It's still operating. It's green now. They've got greenery on the roof that captures CO2 and generates oxygen. They've got light everywhere. I went down on the – actually rode the assembly line, which is a treat. It's not quite going to the West Wing, but it was close. And to talk to the workers, and their experience has changed so much. This is a modern company, and I just love how they've gone into the 21st century with that vision, though, this is the original technology of – industrial era technology, turning it into information era technology, and to do that, of course, they're wiring the cabin. Now they have a challenge, which is distracted driving. They don't, and I think a lot of car companies are not paying much attention. I won't say the name. Big luxury car company on CES's show floor showed how you could update your status on Facebook in their car as you're driving by looking down at the screen, turning a knob to the right status, and pressing go. And it's like, no, don't, please, don't do, no, I don't want to be dodging Mercedes in the street coming in the next few years. Ford's idea is, look, we understand consumers want technology in their car. How do we incorporate it? How do we solve this problem? And after a lot of research, they said, and Alan Mulally told me this, is if you keep your hands on the wheel and the eyes on the road, if you're focused on what you're doing and you're not like looking down and you're not twiddling knobs, you have enough, humans have enough cognitive free space to also have a phone conversation or to listen to stuff or to interact with the car using voice. So that's why they focused on this voice technologies. And that's where Sync comes from. And now Sync and my Ford Touch. And he told me this last year, their cars iterate. They've got the car iteration down about 3 years, which is amazing from the conception to shipping. But it's still, of course, much slower than your Android phone, which seems to update every 3 weeks. So what they've decided to do is they created an API for Sync that allows app developers to interface with the car. So now you can talk to your smartphone and into the apps on the smartphone. So the iteration happens in the phone, and you have that full access. So they started with Pandora. You can literally press a button on your steering wheel. You're driving. You're paying attention to what you're doing. And you say, play my classic rock station. It plays. By the way, this has to terrify radio. Broadcast radio is just going, hey. They've got Stitcher now and Slacker, so you can actually listen to this show. You don't even have to download it ahead of time. Just say, play Twig, and it'll play. You could thumbs up and thumbs down songs. You could do all the things you could do with Pandora with your voice. You can get horoscopes, maps. You can call people. You can play music. You're connected, but you're not distracted. And I think that's really the key to all of this. You can find out more at Ford.com/technology. At CES, they announced 5 or 6 new apps that use this AppLink API. There's many more to come. Ford.com/technology. And, of course, try it today. You can the AppLink is available in the 2012 Ford Fiesta, which you can test drive at a Ford dealer near you. It's actually going to be in all the cars, of course. Ford.com/technology, or drive a Fiesta at a Ford dealer near you. We thank them for their support. I love that story. It's just such a interesting thing to watch. You know, you look at Kodak, which filed Chapter 11. It's so hard to pivot and to watch this industrial era company go into the 21st century and watch. And you know what it is? It's intelligent people. It's, you know, Alan's an engineer from Lockheed, or not Lockheed, Boeing. He says, I was involved in every Boeing cockpit for the last 20 years. He knows all about this stuff, and he's a brilliant engineer, and he engineered the future. Very smart. Let's see. Well, let's talk about, yes, go ahead. Are you losing your battery?
Can I hijack the show before my battery goes out?
Yes.
And do the European SOPA thing. It won't be boring, but I think it's important.
No. It's a huge topic.
So,
ACTA.
Here's the deal. Oh, no, not ACTA this time. This is today. Vivian Reding, who's the vice president of the European Commission, came out with a whole new list of privacy regulations and laws that she plans to implement. And she has 4 pillars. I'm going to go through this real quickly. But there's a lot of dangers. One pillar I agree with is transparency and portability of data. Yay, yay, yay. 2 is privacy by default. Well, if you make privacy the default by law of services, we'd never have a flicker. 3 is that the data must be held by European standards the world around, or else the EU can fine a service up to 2% of their worldwide global take.
Oh.
And so what that means is Europe just is trying to take over the friggin' internet. And it also means we end up with a high watermark of regulation and a low watermark of freedom. And if we grant that power to the EU, we'll grant it to China. 4th pillar is the right to be forgotten, which again sounds cool, but it says that you would have the right to demand that any personal information about you would be deleted. And she has to carve out history and carve out journalism, which acknowledges the impact on freedom of speech. But she's defined personal information as anything about you, including your private public and business and public life, including an IP address. So that means that people could go back and years later come to you, Leo, if you cookie, and demand that you have to get rid of their IP address, not even knowing who that person is, and photos and posts about you in the public. This is extremely dangerous. It is a huge grab to regulate the internet, the whole internet from Europe, across 27 countries. It is truly dangerous. If we got our dander up and we got our action together about SOPA, this is, as Henry Blodgett said to me tonight in the snow of Davos, this is SOPA squared. This is a big deal. And we've got to get mad about this. We've got to get scared about this, because it doesn't just affect Europe. Europe will affect all of us. That's the end of my spiel here. But I'm telling you, folks, watch out for this news. It's dangerous stuff. And it's going to affect media, too, us in media, because it's going to demand that you have to give the right to opt in even to cookieing, which means you wouldn't be able to use the New York Times. Or Leo, one of your people comes to your site from Europe, you're going to have to say,
I'm just going to block
before
them.
I cookie you. Right. But you know, most companies aren't going to do that. And so that's where we end up. It's extremely dangerous. It's a move of a government trying to regulate the internet. It's just as dangerous if Sarkozy does it, or if the American Congress does it with SOPA, or if China does it. And we, the internet, have to fight to keep our tool of publicness free. Thank you for the soapbox.
This is a proposal for Directive 9546, which Does this have to be? How does this get approved? Is this approved by the European Commission?
I mean, obviously, it'll get, it goes to the European Commission.
Does it go to all 27 countries?
It goes in some measure. Some parts of it have to be passed by the 27 countries. They'll have 2 years. Once it's passed by the EU, then the EU dictates the 27 countries must do this, and they'll have 2 years to implement it. And we're going through this right now with cookie directives as we stand today.
So the question, rightly so, in the chat is, well, but this protects me as an individual. How does this hurt me as an individual? Doesn't this protect me?
No, but protect from what? That's the first question of what's the real harm here.
I'll give you an example. So you watch Twit. I'm not interested in any personal information about you. But as with all web servers, we have a log. And the log has who watched when. And we actually do use that to count how many viewers so we can charge our advertisers.
So you did it. So the same argument would be that American Express should delete all of your financial records after 6 months because it says what you did. The library should delete all the records of after a certain time. That you should be able to erase yourself from the whole net.
And this applies to anybody, including us, processing data of any EU citizen.
Exactly.
So U.S. Exactly. anywhere, you're responsible for doing this. And what are the penalties? Let's say Twit says, yeah, go ahead, European Union.
The penalties go up to 2% of your entire, not just
well,
EU,
come and
but
get
your
me.
Entire.
How are they going to get that?
Well, because if you perhaps not, but obviously there's a lot of international companies.
Right.
And so.
So
and,
Google,
and
for instance, would be vulnerable.
Oh, you bet they'd be.
Because Google's all of its money's in Ireland.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Mandatory data protection officer.
Oh yeah, if you have 250 employees, you have to add a full-time staff for data protection. Now you know the advantage he argues is there are now 27 different regulations in 27 countries in Europe, and this puts it together. But this is also it's kind of the one world government of the internet comes along. So who does that? Is it the U.S.? Is it China? Is it Sarkozy? Is it Reading? Is it Germany?
Right.
This is what's happening, my friends, is that, and I see this in Davos right now. Davos is scared shitless of the institutions that are here, of us who, through SOPRA, through Occupy Davos and Occupy Wall Street and the Arab Spring and the Indignados of Spain. These are all movements that scare them.
So you're really at the one, this is a meeting of the 1%. Is that what the WEF is?
Oh, the point one. Yeah, it's the people who are in charge of the 1%. Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay, so they're threatened. By all of this.
Very threatened and full of denial. And this is about a fight about disruption of institutions.
And what? I'm very curious. How aware are they of what's going on? And how real is, clearly Rupert Murdoch's grasp of what's going on is hazy at best. These guys at WEF, these guys you're hanging with in Davos, do they get it? Do they know what's going on?
No, what they got was that SOPA was the reaction to SOPA was scary. That it was people rising up. What they get is that Wall Street.
If
is
you're
weird,
in the if you're
right?
in the 1%, you don't want to hear from the 99. Do your job and stay cool.
Vivian Reding, said, "Well, we'll never have a blocking bill out of Europe." Well, yeah, not now. You're not going to. So they're aware of that. I was at a time debate on the future of capitalism. It's kind of absurd topics this morning. And there was a corporation and an equity firm and labor unions and bankers and universities. And I just got fed up at one point and I said, none of you is accepting responsibility for the mess we're in. You are the disrupted. I want to hear from the disruptors. And they're here too, some of them, but not many. This is the disrupted. And what I'm trying to say is that what we're really seeing at a high level is that the internet threatens institutions. And so the institutions are now fighting back to use the power they have to regulate the internet. And we've got to keep fighting.
Kevin Marks, you have a funny accent. These are your people. Actually, Britain is kind of a reluctant participant in the EU. The chat room is saying that Jeff is biased against Europeans and doesn't understand how it works.
Oi.
Jeff's muted.
Read the regs. Read the regs.
Yeah, read them, and I'll put a link in the show notes, but Jeff's muted. I mean, Kevin, you're muted. We can't hear a word you're saying. Maybe it's that funny accent. There it is. There we go.
There we go. Sorry, another fire engine went past. So
okay.
I muted myself.
Thank you for doing that. We can do that here, too.
Okay. So what about, I think Jeff is overstating this to some extent. Some of the European data protection stuff is useful. The stuff that they have in the UK says that you can demand information from a company that they're holding on you, and they have to send it to you. That's a useful right.
And I'm for that transparency, for it.
Right. There are chunks of this that make sense. There are also ways when they're trying to extend these that don't make sense. And I think this is the first pass at this. And yes, we need to engage with it and make sure that it starts making sense. I think that's very true. And the similarity with SOPA is that these proposals tend to get written by one side of the argument, as you say, by these sort of professional privacy lobbyists. And then we need to look at them and say, well, do you understand the implications of what you're saying and fix them? And with SOPA stuff, there wasn't much to actually fix there. I think with these, there probably is some useful stuff there. And I'm fairly sure that my colleagues at the Open Rights Group and the others who are involved in the policy stuff in Europe will be paying close attention to these and saying, this bits are good, these bits are bad. There was a great article in Computer World by Alex Muffet, which I've got a link to somewhere, talking about that. I think you're like Jeff, talking about the problems of trying to regulate this stuff. He was talking about that debate. It's you need to be careful not to tell people how to do things, but you need to give them frameworks to say what you want to achieve, and that's the difference with good legislation.
Kevin, you're right. Regulate the behavior, not the technology. What's happening here is that whether it's child porn or any of this stuff, we see the government trying to regulate the technology because the technology befuddles and frightens them. When we already have the laws to regulate illegal behavior. Witness the taking down of Mega Upload. They didn't mean so, but it
taken down. But Mega Upload, this is an interesting story because Mega Upload servers were in the U.S., so they could take them down. And everything about SOPA was for international servers.
New Zealand.
Yeah, but that
they arrested them in New Zealand.
They were able to arrest the guys, but if the servers had been in China, they wouldn't have been able to do anything. So, I'm not an apologist for SOPA and PIPA, but I don't think this is a relevant. Mega Upload is not a relevant issue.
What Vivian Redding said was nothing new when she spoke at DLD this week, but I was with executives of a certain very large technology company and a certain part of the advertising industry who were scared to death.
Well, it scares me. I don't know if I should be scared. I know in England anyway, Kevin, there's been a very active and effective, as you said, the open rights movement, political action against this stuff.
Yeah. Well, that was founded like 7 years ago to try and provide a voice for this. Well, one of the things that worried me about the sort of post-SOPA thing was the entertainment industry should sit down with the technology industry. It's like, no, that doesn't necessarily give you the right answer. You also need these. You need some of these people who are representing the broader public interest as well, like the EFF and the Open Rights Group, who are there saying, well, can we look at both sides of this? And there is a danger that you also get people who are, axe grinders who are there with a particular agenda, but there are organizations who actually are focused on thinking this stuff through carefully from the technology angle and from the policy angle.
There are a lot of people, activists, in fact, who believe in privacy, Jeff, and who say, well, we need stronger privacy protection.
I do, too. I believe in privacy. I'm not against privacy. You read the book. I'm not against privacy at all. I think I'm for privacy, but I'm for protecting the tools of publicness, and I'm against regulation of the internet. The internet has been around for decades. Why is it suddenly getting regulated? Why is everybody suddenly seeing danger in the internet? Because the internet's coming together. It's becoming more powerful.
Reasons.
It's becoming economic and also political. It's becoming a force for political change. The internet hasn't changed, folks. The circumstances around it in society have changed. It's having an impact, and that's why they're reacting. And if we reacted to SOPA, I'm all in favor of privacy. I have a private life. Privacy needs protection. I'm in favor of privacy regulations. Make that clear. But I'm also saying here that the internet needs to remain free, and the internet is the tool of disruption, and that's why it's threatened. Its freedom is threatened. I'm about out of battery juice, so you'll be lucky to know.
We're almost out of time. Jeff's out of juice, but I do want to, before we wrap, go ahead, Matthew.
I was just going to say that I think one of the things Jeff, one of the points he raised is a good one, that even if you accept that the goals of, say, the right to be forgotten are good ones, the duty that would impose on companies and the expense and the time and the effort required to do that might be punitive. It just might not be possible.
Right. Yeah. I think that's exactly what he's saying, and that's his issue with SOPA too. Is that maybe the goal is appropriate, but you've got to be careful about how you achieve these goals without doing things that And I think you're right, Jeff, that the scapegoat is often technology because it's scary. Whether it's political, economic, or just we're Luddites, it's scary.
So I didn't mean to hijack so much. I apologize.
No, but, that's good.
I got.
Well, it's scary because people are using it.
Right.
Oh. Right. That's a good thing, and that's what we want.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
Pseudonyms. Google has Google Plus says, yeah, you can use a NIM. Good article Monday from you, Kevin Marks. Google admits they want they want fake names, but do you have to be famous? What is the deal?
It's kind of the same thing they've been saying all along, but they've been direct about it. You're not, you know, Bradley wrote a sort of PR-y thing. Oh, we've done this stuff, and then Jonathan Zunger in the comments said what was actually going on, which is they have decided that people don't like the look of handles. And so they have an algorithm that tries to decide if your name looks real or not. They don't care if it is real or not. They just want them to look right. Like names. So it's this. The thing it reminds me of is...
It's so broken.
People working in call centers so have to Google. Pretend they're American. You know, it's like a passing thing. It's like you have to look normal because you're scared the mainstream Americans or whatever. And so what they've explicitly said is your name has to be... look name-like enough to our algorithm. Now, their algorithm lets through a whole bunch of crap. You know, mm-hmm. I checked 30 of mine, and I got... let me look it up again. I got The Phoenix Rising, Panel Heater, Tous les Mets du Monde, and the one called Mayor Decent, which is actually obviously a fake account using a Pakistani actress's photo. And that was out of the last 30 people who followed me at that point. So their algorithm is failing in its goal of... creating things that look like real names, and they are attacking people who use names that they want to use. Now, they've said, oh, if you can show us you've been using this name on the internet for a while, you can go through the appeals process. Well, Kalia Hamlin went through the appeals process, and it is ridiculous, and it clearly is designed to mess you around and you know, make you back off. So it's really annoying. they still haven't picked
well
up
said.
Me.
Well
Ozzy's annoyed too. My dog's annoyed too. Gina, what are your thoughts? Were you cheered by this change, or does it seem like it's meaningless?
I was cheered that there was a change. Still kind of annoying. I mean, I sort of agree with Google that they want to that a community of real names has a different vibe to it than a community of handles that can be anything. But I'm still not convinced they're quite handling this right yet. I'm still also really suspicious that most of my, you know, people who have put me in their circles on Google Plus are spammers. So
yeah.
There's also that. I mean, my follow numbers are insane, and it just seems, and I just get a lot of spam. And so, yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about this yet. Although I do have friends who have handles who use them on Twitter and other social networks and have had them for years, who are now finally getting their Google profiles restored, and that makes me happy.
It does seem like there's an awful lot of spam on Google Plus, more than there is on Facebook. So clearly, this didn't, whatever they did, didn't quite work.
It doesn't help.
Yeah.
You know, I think in a way we've got the worst of both worlds. We've got Google, we've got Google pretending that they're having real names,
right?
But they're not, because it's right. As long as it's what I call the real looking names policy. Well, what purpose does that serve? Why not let people use whatever name they want? And the thing that I like about Twitter is that you can use whatever handle you want, and most people attach their real name to it. Some people don't, but then it's about the quality of the content, and then you can start, you know, forming your community around that instead of what someone's name is.
But Twitter, I mean, there's your handle, and then there's your full name. You know, you kind of have both,
right.
Really.
And I think Google's trying to do that. So they're saying there's this other field,
right.
And you can have your handle in there, but we still need your real name or your real looking name, which, right. You know, it feels like the worst of both worlds instead of the best.
Let us get to our... tool tip and number of the week before Jeff's battery dies. Why don't you do the number first as the air escapes from Jeff's balloon head?
I will confess that I cheated and teacher gave me a number.
I gave you a number. But it's a good number.
It's a good number. 9.68 million. That's how much Google's spending on lobbying, which I would just say simply is still not enough.
Not even close.
No.
Although members of Congress are cheaper than they used to be. A few thousand gets you a vote. So,
yeah, but if Google saw it's if Google, and I think this is where the discussion early in the show was right. If Google truly were aligned with our interests, if it truly were were able to do that and did that well, then they wouldn't need a lobbyist because we proved with SOPA that we are the lobby.
Right. Let us be the lobby, Google. By the way, that number is twice what they spent last year, 2010. That's the 2011 number. So it is going up.
Going up.
Yeah.
Half of it is...
That will continue to go up, I bet.
Half of it's car fare for Eric Schmidt.
And I'm going to apologize, but rather than just fading away, I'm
going to
go off.
Goodbye, Jeff. Say hello to the 1.1, the 0.1%.
Say hello to Bono for us.
Bono's not there this year. Mick Jagger might be. No. We're not sure.
I'll try to dance with him.
Find Mick. See you, Jeff. Thank you. Jeff Jarvis, yeah. BuzzMachine.com. His new book, Public Parts, available at better bookstores everywhere. And he'll be back next week, I'm sure. Enjoy Davos. Enjoy the 6 feet of snow. Gina, you have a tip for us?
Yes, I do.
12 feet?
Sure.
Wow. Go ahead.
I like this. Google Maps now highlights an area. So if you search for Petaluma, or if you search for a zip code, or if you search for a county, the Google Maps, if you're in, not in satellite view, but in just regular map view, it'll highlight the area in pink. So you can actually see the boundaries of a zip code or a city. So if you search for Brooklyn, New York, you can see how big my hometown really is, or my home borough really is. It's just a neat feature if you kind of want to get a sense of different areas and neighborhoods. It might even work for just neighborhoods as well.
That's cool. And yeah, they've added a bunch more 3D renderings as well. Like they said, 42 plus more locations. Let me just see. Brooklyn, New York, New York. Let's zoom in on that here.
And you have to be in map mode. You're in satellite mode right now.
Oh, yes. Let's go to map mode. I don't even know how to do it. Wait a minute. What happened? There. Click that. There we go. Oh, yeah. Look. They're pink.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you zoom out, you can kind of see the highlighted area. Exactly.
That's where it is. I always wondered.
It works really well for zip codes as well, if you want to get a sense.
That's cool. Let's see. Let's look at our zip code, 94952.
Does it work for congressional districts? That would be cool.
Oh, now that's what we should do. Yeah. Let's see the 11th congressional district. That's what we need.
Oh, interesting. Not sure if that's going to work.
Wouldn't that surprise you? I'm sorry. I just have to try this. Oh, I don't know what state. There it is. California's 11th congressional district. It gave me a dot, though. It showed me where it is.
Right, but it's not a boundary.
There, I need an outline. Wouldn't that be nice? Hey, at least it's on the map.
Because they do the where to vote thing. So they have that in the Google Politics thing they built last year.
I get it. That's cool. I was going to make my tool be something that apparently Google doesn't want you to use. So I was going to do this last week. I should have. It was so cool. It was called Google's Sesame. It would give you a QR code. Did I do that wrong? It would give you a QR code that you could use to log in from mobile phones and so forth. So a QR code for your account, making it so easy. And turns out it wasn't a public service at all. It was an experiment that never was intended to be exposed. And the guy who, I got to find this, because they have a thank you for your interest. Goodbye. We'll find out something. We'll do something better next time, but that's not it. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here. There was so much more to talk about. I just this is such a good subject in general for everything that we do. Matthew Ingram is the Eminence Grise at the. I love that, Matthew. That's your new title. I think that should be on your card.
It's Latin for old.
Old man at gigaohm.com. And you can catch his writing there. He's also on Twitter at Matthew I. Thank you, Matthew, for being here.
Thanks.
Kevin Marks is at Herba Buena Gardens enjoying the beautiful weather. I think tomorrow it's going to be in the 70s. So if you're coming for Mac World Expo, you're going to be in good shape. You can catch his show, Tunnel Vision. He does it with Heather and Deborah and Deb Schultz, and it's just a great show. Tunnelvision.tv to see more at Kevin Marks.
Tomorrow night at 6.
Tomorrow night at 6. Thank you, Kevin. Always a pleasure to get an intelligent person on here. Speaking of he's got a British accent. That makes him sound smarter.
Yeah, the authority.
I think Gina and Jeff are pretty smart, too.
Oh, I don't know. Gina's pretty darn smart, you bet. Gina Trapani, smarterware.org. Even her website says so. She's brilliant. Of course she is.
This is a great conversation today.
Really interesting. Loved it.
Yeah. Thanks, Matthew and Kevin, for joining us.
This is just such a great show to do. Here it is. Here's the accounts.google.com/sesame. This sounds like something Douglas Adams would have written. Hello there. Thank you for your interest in our phone-based login experiment. We have concluded this particular experiment. Stay tuned for something even better. Bye-bye. Thank you all for being here. We do this show every Wednesday afternoon, about 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, at Twit TV. You can watch us live, but if you don't worry. We make audio and video available for download from this site, but also from iTunes and everywhere better podcasts are stored. Please tune in again next week and stay tuned. Tech News Today is coming up next with Tom, Iaz, and Sarah and the latest technology news. Have a great week. Thanks for joining us on This Week in Google.
And my battery just went to zero.
Yay! Oh, you got it all the way down. Thank you, Kevin. Really
thanks,
nice.
Kevin.
You got the.
I guess what the QR code things is that they did the experiment and found they were absolutely for logging in.
They didn't work.
Yeah, probably didn't work.
There was a museum that started trying using QR codes, and they found that the uptake was 80% down compared to having a text thing that people would put
in.
Basically, QR codes work if you have a dedicated scanner, but they're completely useless with most phones.